You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Harley Davidson's tax burden went down under last year's Republican-backed tax overhaul. We'll look at how that played out for the company's workers and shareholders over the last few months. Now, a bill spearheaded by Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson has passed the House of Representatives and is awaiting President Trump's signature. The Trickett-Wendler Right to Try Act allows terminally ill patients to seek out experimental medical treatments that haven't been approved yet by the FDA. Senator Johnson is with us now to talk about the bill and why he made the case for it in Congress. Senator Johnson, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. How are you doing?
Good. How did this right to try legislation first come to your attention?
Well, I met with the Goldwater Institute a couple weeks before I met Trickett-Wendler. And Trickett, of course, was a young mom, three children. She had suffering from ALS. And the fact that I just mentioned right to try and that I supported it, literally tears started streaming down her cheeks. And it was really at that moment I said, okay, I'm now in support of this effort. I'm going to champion it. And that was in 2013. We since lost Trickett. She lost her battle to ALS in 2015. But along the way, I met Frank Mangiello, a fellow who right now is suffering from ALS. He has six kids. Matt Bellina is a former naval aviator. He also is suffering from ALS. And then little Jordan McGlynn, suffering from Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and his mom, Laura. These are just four of the people. They're the namesakes of the bill, but they just represent the thousands of terminally ill patients and their families who have no other treatment options. They don't qualify for a clinical trial, and all they're asking is if a drug is passed the safety approval, the phase one approval of the FDA approval process, still is in the approval process, which means the drug companies still think they have promise, so they're willing to spend millions of dollars trying to get that FDA approval. Rather than an unelected bureaucrat in the FDA making that decision, we're going to let patients, their families, and their doctors make the decision whether they want to try a drug that just hasn't completed the efficacy approval process to the FDA. We're giving that little bit of freedom, that little bit of hope to these terminally ill patients.
Yeah, that's the heart of this legislation, right? Can you talk kind of on a technical level, what changes when this gets signed?
Well, it should be signed next Wednesday is what we believe, the signing ceremony. And what changes is, again, these terminally ill patients who in the past, the FDA sometimes says no. Here's a case in point. Dr. Del Passant, an oncologist in Houston, Texas, was involved in an FDA clinical trial for a very aggressive form of endocrine cancer. And he had 150 patients signed up, and the drug was working. And so he had another 73 patients he wanted to put on the trial, apply to the FDA, and the FDA said no. But because he had the Texas rights to try law without liability protection, he took the risk on his career, his reputation, as well as any money he might have, any kind of assets. And he signed those patients up. He started giving them the drug. In the end, he added another 179 patients to his trial without FDA approval. That drug was eventually approved about 32 months later, and more than 130 of those patients were still alive once the drug was approved because of his courage, because of right to try. So this law will save lives. It does give people a little bit of hope. It's not a cure. It's not a panacea, but it's a little bit of freedom that I think these terminally ill patients more than deserve.
You mentioned the FDA. They have this compassionate use program. They, as I understand it, have a very high approval rate. 99.4% of the time they say, yeah, give it a shot, go for it. Only in special, exceptional cases do they not approve it. So that being the case, is this going to change that much for that many people?
It will, because really the only people that apply are the ones that they already know they're going to get approved. In France, it has a fifth of our population. I think last year 12,000 people were approved through their expanded access program. We approved less than 2,000, I think, last year. I heard on the floor of the House, one of the House members said it was only 400. So there is something wrong with our expanded access. It's not as inclusive as we'd like it to be. And so Right to Try just makes, you know, obviously gives those patients that don't believe and haven't been approved or wouldn't be approved under expanded access the ability to try these drugs.
Talking to Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about the right to try legislation. It's passed Congress waiting for a signature. He says it looks like Wednesday from the president, giving patients, terminally ill patients, more access to medications at the early stage in the development process. Senator Johnson, some people have said this is likely to give a lot of people maybe false hope that because these medications are at such an early stage. All we know about them is they're not, you know, deadly in the short run. We don't have any sign that they're things that are going to work. What do you say to them?
Talk to somebody with ALS or a terminal cancer where there are no treatment options. But to talk to one of those individuals and their family members and ask them if they even believe there's something called false hope. They'll take any kind of hope. They have no hope. They have no treatment options. They are facing imminent death. And all they're asking for is the right of, I believe, every American to have the freedom to make that choice themselves, not a faceless bureaucrat. Again, there are far too many times with FDA bureaucrats just saying no, and they deny people drugs that eventually get approved and would have saved potentially one of their loved ones' lives had the FDA only said yes. So we're going to take it out of the hands of FDA bureaucrats that, you know, don't have that personal connection to those family members that are facing death, and we're going to give that that right to the individuals and their families.
A timeline, if this is in fact signed into law next week, is it instantly in effect? Is it something that's going to be phased in over time?
My hope is it's pretty much instantly in effect. Matt Bellina, that naval aviator suffering from ALS, he told me two Israeli drug manufacturers that have experimental drugs on ALS. They're going through the process. They've passed the phase one safety approval process, and they will make that available because now they have the liability protection. That's what they're telling Matt. So the sooner that occurs, the sooner Matt Bellina can at least try something, give him some measure of hope.
You had, I believe, a Democratic co-sponsor on this. I think there's a lot of focus on partisan differences in the Senate and the House. Is this an example, do you think, of ways that people can reach across the aisle?
Yeah, we actually end up having 46 co-sponsors in the Senate, which is kind of unusual. We had three Democrats, and then we worked with Ranking Member Patty Murray of the Health Committee, and in the end, in the Senate, this passed unanimously. It was passed by unanimous consent. Where Right to Try was passed in states, 40 states passed this, more than 97% of state legislators voted yes. It finally came up against the final hurdle in the House, and so the people opposed to it basically pulled out all the stops, and so it became a little bit more partisan issue in the House. But in 40 states in the United States Senate, it passed overwhelmingly, and I'm so glad that now it will be signed into law.
I want to switch gears for our last few minutes talking here today. Senator Johnson, your office sent a press release earlier. There's the North Korea meeting canceled. You asked Secretary of State Mike Pompeo about that earlier today. What are your thoughts on the cancellation, at least for now, of this meeting between the president and the leader of North Korea?
Well, it's unfortunate that Kim Jong-un decided not to move forward in good faith. What I asked Mike Pompeo in the hearing today in Senate Foreign Relations Committee was, I just want to confirm that in his meetings with Kim Jong-un, that he made perfectly clear, crystal clear, exactly what dismantlement meant. It meant complete, permanent, irreversible, verifiable dismantlement. Kim Jong-un fully understood that, and based on that understanding, released three hostages. So I'm not exactly sure what happened between now and then. My guess is he's trying to play the same games his father and grandfather played, thinking he can get away with it. He won't be able to get away with it. We've seen this this rodeo before, as well as, of course, in Iran, because when we relaxed the pressure of the sanctions, you know, we got an awful deal in terms of the Iranian deal as well. So the Trump administration is going to hold steadfast, and I think is completely appropriate based on Kim Jong-un's recent comments for us to cancel, you know, at least temporarily cancel that meeting. Hopefully Kim Jong-un will come to his senses and realize this is by far in the best interest of him personally, as well as his people, to completely dismantle his nuclear and ballistic missile programs.
If he doesn't come back to the table, what are you looking for in the U.S. response and U.S. efforts to keep up pressure toward denuclearization?
Well, one of the reasons I continue to counsel the Trump administration to maintain a relationship with China that realizes our top priority in that relationship is obtaining their maintaining their cooperation to maintain those sanctions, that maximum pressure campaign. It'll be through that maximum pressure campaign that is the only thing that will make Kim Jong-un give up his very dangerous weapons.
Do you think there's a carrot and stick approach? Can we hold out the hope of to North Korea of improved trade, of relaxing embargoes if they do come back to the negotiating table?
That's exactly what Secretary Pompeo and President Trump was offering Kim Jong-un. But again, we are the stick is he must agree to, again, complete verifiable irreversible dismantlement. He understood that when he agreed to the talks. So again, he's trying to play the game. The Trump administration is not going to let him get away with playing that game.
People have pointed out that maybe he never wanted complete denuclearization. He looked at places like Iraq and Libya without nuclear weapons programs of their own, regimes that are no longer with us. Is it really in his interests to not have nuclear weapons?
I believe it is. A completely different situation. He'll have China there pretty well guaranteeing his security as a dear leader. That's the concession that will have to be made. We're going to have to guarantee his survival of himself and his regime. But in return for dismantlement, his nation, his people will receive so many benefits. It's dramatically in his best interest, as well as this is where the interests of China and America align as well. So this is a win-win-win for everybody if he does do that complete dismantlement.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Senator Johnson, it's an election year, not for you personally, but what are you hoping to accomplish in the Senate in this election year?
Well, I certainly would like to have a Republican colleague in the Senate so that we're voting in concert and we really have the same viewpoint in terms of reducing the regulatory burden, continuing to have a competitive tax system so we can move our economy forward, get economic growth for greater prosperity, higher wages and benefits for every Wisconsinite and every American.
We'll leave it there for now. Senator Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
Have a great day.
That's Senator Ron Johnson, Republican representing Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate. He joined us today to talk about the passage of his Right to Try bill, which will allow terminally ill patients to seek experimental treatments. As you heard, we got his thoughts on the latest news in the non-meeting now with the leader of North Korea. First, when Republicans in Congress were working on passing tax legislation last year, manufacturing and American jobs were major talking points. One of the companies that lawmakers said would reap the benefits of a tax overhaul was Wisconsin's Harley-Davidson. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan talking at Harley's headquarters last September.
Tax reform can stop punishing companies for making things in America and selling them overseas. Tax reform can put American manufacturers and American companies like Harley-Davidson on a much better footing to compete in the global economy and keep jobs here in America.
While Harley did end up getting a tax break under the new law, that didn't necessarily translate into new job creation. In January, the company decided to close its factory in Kansas City, and days later it announced a costly stock buyback for its shareholders. Some companies have attributed new hiring and wage hikes to the tax overhaul, but Harley's moves raise questions about who benefits most from corporate tax breaks. Emily Stewart is a reporter for Vox. She recently wrote about this. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
In the run-up to the tax cut bill, the federal tax cut bill, Republican leaders talked about Harley-Davidson, among other companies, quite a bit. What kind of things were they saying about Harley as they were pitching their overhaul of the tax system?
I mean, you had Paul Ryan go visit a factory in Menominee Falls and sort of say, you know, the tax bill, like they were saying to every company, like they were saying to America, this is going to keep jobs here, this is going to revive manufacturing, this is going to do wonders for the economy. And Harley-Davidson happened to be one of the companies that sort of they trotted out as like a big example of a company that would benefit from taxes, from different changes to trade, things like that.
How did the corporate tax cuts affect Harley-Davidson? How much did their tax burden change after it passed?
So it went down from about 10%. Their effective tax rate, so basically what they pay, they think it will be between 23 and 25% this year. So that's 10% less than they paid last year.
So it ends up being a decent chunk of money. And you looked at what happened with the company next, and you saw a couple things. One was this factory in Kansas City. Tell us about that.
Right. So on January 30th, Harley brought in its workers for the day and basically told them that they were shutting the plant down. They are going to do that at the end of 2019. Told them, you know, within the next year and a half, your jobs will be gone. We're going to consolidate operations to a plant in Pennsylvania. Now, in Pennsylvania, they're going to add about 450 jobs, but that's still a net loss of 350 jobs. A few days, literally like 4 or 5 days after they make this announcement about the Kansas City plant, Harley announces a stock buyback, essentially saying that they're going to spend about $700 million buying back their shares, which will obviously benefit their shareholders. So you kind of have this situation where they're saying we don't have money, you know, to keep this factory open, but at the same time, they're saying, well, we can do this stock buyback. So it just kind of, the timing looks a little funky, and they got this big, you know, windfall from the tax bill. Why not think of a way to sort of help these workers out?
And stock buybacks have been a big thing, you write, since the tax bill passed. Is this something, Harley's not alone here on stock buybacks?
No, I mean, stock buybacks really have been trending upwards for years. But what we've seen is that the tax bill has sort of juiced it. If you remember Apple, I think last month or this month, they announced $100 billion, which is an enormous amount of money. And a lot of companies have done it. Cisco has done it. I think right now they're looking at $178 billion of buybacks announced this year alone. It's record numbers that they haven't seen since before the financial crisis. So Harley's certainly not alone in doing this, but it is... I mean, that's what the tax bill is going for, or at least that's a good part of what the tax bill is going for.
And what did workers at that Kansas City plant say about the closure? Did they talk about the buybacks too, making that same connection?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people, when it comes like stock buybacks, you're not even really like looking at it or thinking about it. And a lot of the workers have also pointed out that Harley is opening up a plant in Thailand. And Harley says that it's not job outsourcing, it's not connected. But, you know, a lot of the workers say, well, if you don't have money to keep this plant open, then why are you opening up a plant in Thailand? It's, you know, people are definitely upset and frustrated. And when you look at Harley went to Kansas City in the 1990s, it was sort of a big deal when they went there. They got tax incentives to go there. And so years later, for them to sort of pick up and say, we're done here, people are obviously upset.
What has Harley said about why they closed this particular plant?
I mean, basically they say, you know, we're sorry, we didn't want to, but this is a business decision that we need to make. Harley Davidson, sort of their consumer base has been aging a lot, and young people just are not buying Harleys at the rate that their parents maybe did. So there's no doubt that their U.S. operations are not going as well as they used to. And Harley just kind of says, you know, this is a business decision that we need to make.
Talking to Emily Stewart, reporter at Vox, about a piece she wrote on the tax cuts passed earlier this year, Harley Davidson, a plant closure and stock buybacks. Has Harley commented on the timing of the stock buybacks related to the tax cuts and the plant closure?
No, really, they didn't want to talk about this story at all. They sent to me one statement that they sent out at the time that they did it, saying that the decision to close the plant was not taken lightly. But in terms of the buyback, they really haven't said a lot. On their earnings call, some of their executives said, you know, we do want to continue to reward shareholders, which, again, is not unique to Harley-Davidson or any publicly traded company, but they haven't really commented on the timing of it.
A case could be made for any company doing something like this. Okay, they're closing one of their, you know, maybe a little older factories amidst, you know, overcapacity to produce the stock buyback. Yes, it rewards people in the short term. It might leave them in a better position for the future. Is there a case? Are people making the case that, okay, short term, there are some job losses, but this guarantees a healthier company and jobs in the future?
I mean, I talked to one analyst who said, you know, the closing, I mean, I don't know if it leads to jobs, but that the company, this is something that needed to be done, that things are not going particularly well for Harley, specifically in the United States. Its business has shrunk a little bit, and so this is sort of just a business decision that they needed to make. Now, whether that will lead to more jobs, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if the motorcycle market will improve or not, but there is an argument to be made that they needed to do this, and you know, companies also do have to pay attention to their shareholders, and they have a fiduciary duty. You know, there isn't a way to understand sort of what they've done. The timing, I think, to me, looks a little bit just unfortunate at the very least.
And union members, I'd asked about the stock buybacks in particular. Are union members in Kansas City, this plant that's closing, talking about the timing after the tax cut and trying to maybe get national attention here to keep the jobs around?
Well, they, you know, I reached out to them, but they also point out one of the presidents of one of the unions had actually written to President Trump, because Trump also brought Harley Davidson to the White House right after he was inaugurated to say, you know, we're going to revive Harley. And he specifically, again, talked about the tax cuts. So they have reached out to the president to ask and see if he will do something like he did for the carrier plant, say, in Indiana, when he kind of tried to insist that they keep jobs there. And they also met with Pierre Navarro, who's one of his trade advisors, but they have not heard back.
We'll leave it there for now. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Stewart is a reporter at Vox. She joined us to talk about what's been happening at Harley-Davidson in the wake of last year's overhaul of the tax system. Now, America's birth rate continues to fall. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 3.8 million babies were born last year. That's down 2% from 2016 and the lowest recorded number of births in 30 years. In addition, birth rates generally decline for women under 40, reaching record lows among women in their 20s. However, the birth rate for women in their early 40s actually went up. The report has some demographers wondering whether the downward trend is going to continue and what that could mean for the country's economic future. And by the way, according to the post-World War II figures from the state, Wisconsin's birth rate has followed national trends at a slightly lower clip. So why are people having fewer kids, or at least delaying childbirth? Karen Benjamin-Guzzo is an associate professor of sociology at Bowling Green State University. She's also the associate director there of the Center for Family and Demographic Research. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Well, I think the question people ask when they see numbers like this, record lows, 30-year lows in numbers of births, is why? What's going on?
Well, I think that despite the sort of uptick in the economy and the downturn in unemployment, that we have this overall picture that things are going well. But I think for individuals, especially those in their prime childbearing years, the ones we call millennials, they're not feeling that certain about things. They're not feeling that recovery that we're supposedly having. And so people feel really uncertain. And when you're uncertain about your future and what the next couple of years hold for you, I think you're unlikely to say, gee, now's a good time to have kids. So people, I think, are generally kind of delaying until later. So if you're in your 20s in particular, you think, okay, well, I've still got my 30s. I can do this later. And so it's those in their late 30s and 40s, there's no later for them. So they're less likely to be delaying, although births are down for those 35-year-olds and to 40-year-olds. But I think people are just really feeling uncertain about their futures, and so they're putting off having kids. I don't think people are saying, I don't want to have kids at all. They're saying, not now. And unfortunately, they've been feeling that way now for about 10 years.
Do we often see a birth rates tracking with economic certainty or uncertainty?
Yes. Generally, when the economy is bad and there's uncertainty, people delay having kids, birth rates go down. There's even a little bit of evidence that uncertainty actually starts to predict these downturns in the economy, that birth rates actually start to go down a little before the economy starts to go bad. So there is some concern that maybe this is maybe an indicator of another, you know, back down into another recession. That one I hope is not true.
Is there a kind of a hangover effect where, okay, we had these millennials coming into the workforce at, you know, a really bad time, the Great Recession, 2008, that few years there. As a result, they weren't making money then. They weren't able to pay off student loans. They weren't able to buy houses. Like, they had this economic setback that they're still feeling now. Even if they've got the good job now, they're still trying to catch up with what happened 10 years ago.
Absolutely, absolutely. So today's young adults, those in their 20s and early 30s, they still have this crushing student loan debt. Many of them spent a lot of years being unemployed or underemployed, going back to school, trying to work and go to school. They haven't been able to afford a house. So we still have record high levels of parental co-residence, you know, young adults living with their parents. That it makes you sort of wary of, you know, really saying, all right, I'm an adult, I'm stable, I'm ready to, you know, take that next step, because taking, you know, becoming a parent's pretty irreversible. And so I think people do have this kind of hangover effect where they're just not that certain. And even those who on paper look like they're doing pretty well now, it wasn't that long ago that things were uncertain. And I think right now in our kind of political situation, I think people still feel like there's a lot that could go wrong very quickly, and just are not feeling that confident in the short-term future.
Karen Benjamin-Guzzo is with us from Bowling Green State University, sociologist there, associate director of the Center for Family and Demographic Research, talking about America's declining birth rate, declining fertility rate. Karen, what are the consequences if we have this prolonged decline in the number of births? What kind of things do we watch for down the road?
Well, sort of the big consequence that we worry about is what demographers call the aging of the population. If fewer young people are being born, then our average age gets older and older, and we worry about at what point do we not have enough young adults and future generations coming through to be able to support the older generations to pay into Social Security and Medicare. And so we worry about that. We want to make sure we have enough people to work, you know, to fuel our workforce. So the U.S. is a little unique compared to some of our developed country peers in that we're actually tracking what everyone else is doing in terms of birth rates. They're going down for everybody. But we have immigration that actually props up our workforce and keeps our population fairly stable overall in size. So if immigration turns down and we can't get these births to kind of go back up, we do have some real problems that we're going to have to face, both in terms of decisions about, you know, Social Security and other programs like that, but also as an economy, you know, who's going to work in our jobs?
I wanted to ask about developed countries in general. As you mentioned, we see declining birth rates in a lot of countries. Maybe it goes up and down a little bit depending on the economy, but is there this overall trend as economies get more and more developed in the modern era, birth rates go down?
Yes. That is definitely the case. I mean, the U.S. is, I think, probably a more pro-family country, pro-child country than a lot of our peers are. But that's generally the case, that as we get more educated as a population, and that particularly includes women, women are getting more educated, women's labor force is rising, or at least has been overall rising over the past 50 years, that women are working. And we as a society, and a lot of the other developed countries as well, don't make it really easy for women and for couples to have, you know, sort of this dual family or dual employment situation and to raise a family. We don't have paid maternity leave. We don't have good child care. It's really expensive. And so countries tend to have higher fertility, higher birth rates if they can help support families and help people still keep working. But when that doesn't happen, we do see that birth rates go down. And they're really hard to recover once if we go too far down this path. So places like Japan, for instance, are having a really tough time getting people to have more kids.
With something as huge a trend as demographics, are there examples of countries moving the needle saying, hey, we're a developed country, our birth rate is going down, we're worried about this, we change policies, and then it actually does move the needle?
Yeah, it's rarely sort of a single policy, but the Scandinavian countries are the ones that we tend to, as demographers, look towards as good examples of keeping fertility rates pretty stable, because they have some really generous maternity leave policies, but also paternity leave and general parental leave. They offer free child care. You know, they do pay higher taxes for all this, but their economies are more stable, and so are their birth rates and their populations. People are happier. Parents are better off. They stay together longer. They both parents are more involved. They have much higher rates of father involvement, in part because the expectation is that dads will take time off, dads will help out. So they are, you know, there are policies that do it, but it's this sort of global, or not global, but I mean kind of a large spread effort to say we've got to make it easier for people and families to both work and raise a family, and we need to prioritize families and children. And the U.S. has not done that.
We're talking to Karen Benjamin-Guzzo. She's an associate professor of sociology at Bowling Green State University, associate director of the Center for Family and Demographic Research. We're talking about the record low birth rate for the United States and what it might mean for America's economic future. You can join in at 800-642-1234, especially if you are part of this story. Are you in that childbearing age where people commonly have kids, 20s, 30s? Are you one of the families that had one of those 3.8 million kids last year? Have you decided to hold off on having kids for a while, forever, till things settle down? Do you feel that pressure that Karen was talking about earlier? You don't feel economically settled enough to have kids right now, maybe down the road. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. We continue our discussion about the U.S. birth rate hitting a record low in 2017. 3.8 million babies were born last year, down 2% from the previous year. Lowest number in 30 years, lowest rate. As I understand it, since we started keeping track of such things, Karen Benjamin Guzzo is an associate professor of sociology at Bowling Green State University, associate director of the Center for Family and Demographic Research. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you putting off having kids, opting to have no kids? Why? Why not? Maybe fewer children than perhaps you planned, or more. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Karen, before we go to our callers, I don't know if this new CDC data tells us this story, but do we know, is this families deciding to have no children versus one or two? Is this families deciding to have one or two instead of three or four? Do we know how that all plays out?
That's a great question, and that's really, I think, an important part of the story. So from this report, we can't tell that, but we have earlier reports with more complete information. And what seems to be the case is people are delaying having that first kid, but they're also actually putting off having maybe a second or third, or they're choosing to just have one child or only to have two. And again, what tends to happen is a lot of times people don't know what they're getting into with one in terms of some of the costs or how difficult it is to work and do other things. And so they have one child and they realize, oh, my goodness, I can't afford to have another kid in daycare. Or suddenly my house is much smaller than I needed. Or I need to, you know, do I want to raise a kid in this neighborhood? Should I move to the suburbs or do I need a different school system? And so I think people are thinking maybe also about having fewer children than they maybe perhaps originally wanted.
Let's bring our callers on now. Tyler is with us in La Crosse. Tyler, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring up, Tyler?
Yeah, so my question for your caller is I'm curious of, what the data is on contraceptive availability in youth and young people and how that's kind of affected the birth rate. I work in healthcare, and it seems like almost every woman of childbearing age that I come across is on some form of oral contraceptive or some implantable device.
Tyler, thanks for the call. Karen, do we know, is contraceptive use like that moving the needle on fertility?
Absolutely. So one of the big things that we're happy about in the reproductive field is that we are seeing a lot fewer teen births and unintended or unplanned pregnancies and births. And that is because people are using contraception more and they're using better methods. So with the Affordable Care Act, that has really expanded the ability for people, for young women in particular, to be able to afford the most effective kinds of methods and to be able to access those. And so the increased usage is probably part of that story of why we're seeing fewer births. And particularly among the biggest decline is really among teens and young adults, those in the early 20s. And it's probably because they're finally being able to access and use the most effective methods of contraception.
Tyler, thanks for the call. We have Kurt with us now in Appleton. Kurt, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I guess my view on that is I don't think it's necessarily a referendum of how you feel about the economy or anything else. When I was in those prime years to have children, we simply chose not to have children just from a standpoint of, where all these jobs come from as we become less industrialized and less agrarian. What's the impact on the economy? Where there's a certain ceiling on what's a sustainable population to have, and I don't think it's a bad idea to simply opt out of increasing that population.
Kurt, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, Karen, how much is there out there of people making that conscious decision, not I'm not going to have kids now because I can't afford it, but has it gotten more acceptable for people to say, you know what, I, for various reasons, just don't want to have kids, period?
Yeah, absolutely. That there is a growing acceptability of simply choosing not to have children. We call that voluntarily childless. And that's absolutely the case that's also growing. Although that has, in general, that I don't think that plays a big part in it. Because just there are some groups, and we are seeing that more married couples choosing not to have kids, but we're seeing more unwed mothers and never married mothers or never married individuals choosing to have kids outside of marriage. So that's sort of balancing out. It used to be that if you didn't marry, you didn't have the chance. And now that's not necessarily the case. But there are people who are saying to themselves, I don't think that's what I want for whatever reason. Having children is not something in my that interests me or something I think is a good idea. But that number, the proportion of women who never have kids seems to actually have gone down a little bit since its peak in the kind of the 1990s and early 2000s. Oh, actually, it peaked during the Depression, but in recent years, the proportion of women who never have kids has actually gone down a bit. I think because we are seeing more people trying to make it work, trying to have both a career and family.
Kurt, thanks for the call. Jackie is with us now in Madison. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I heard you guys talking, so I wanted to call in. I just turned 40 last year and had my fifth baby 4 months ago. And I was pregnant with my third and fourth children. I have twins when I was just finishing up my master's degree. So I think for me and my husband, we've been together a very long time and just decided that, you know, we needed to focus on school before we had kids. And so I was in my early 30s before we even had our first child. But really, I mean, trying to do all of it, you know, try to have the career, but we also wanted to have the family was really important for us too. And especially with the cost of having kids, I mean, having a education can definitely contribute to our family size.
Jackie, thanks a lot for the call. In our last few moments, Karen, that was a family waited till their 30s, then now on their fifth kid. Is that something we're seeing? People do have kids, but they start later, 10 years later, maybe, than they used to?
Absolutely. The average age at first parenthood or having that first kid has definitely creeped up. And we are seeing birth rates still increasing for women in their late 30s, maybe not in the most recent year, but definitely still increasing for those in their 40s. So there is, it can't keep going forever, but it does seem that people are delaying, but they're not necessarily forgoing it. Now, if you don't start having kids till you're 35 or even 40, it's going to be tough for you to have five kids at that point. But it's definitely the case that just because you haven't had kids by 30 or even 35 doesn't mean you're not necessarily ever going to have children.
And just briefly, Karen, I know this is hard to predict. It's based on millions of individual decisions. Do you expect the fertility rate to keep going down from year to year?
I don't think so. I think in the next couple of years we might see maybe a little more decline. I do think it eventually will level off, that we'll kind of remain at this around two, give or take, you know, two kids per person on average. That tends to be what we need to keep a population going, and so I'm not entirely pessimistic yet.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Karen Benjamin-Guzzo, Associate Professor of Sociology at Bowling Green State University, also the Associate Director of the Center for Family and Demographic Research. We talked with her about the record low U.S. birth rate. It may be months before a cause is determined for the medical helicopter crash that killed three crew members in northern Wisconsin. But as Glenn Moberg reports, at least one experienced observer is questioning whether single-engine helicopters like the one that crashed should be used for medical transport.
1,200 people, many of them paramedics, filled Holy Family Church to pay their respects to the Ascension Spirit crew, pilot Rico Caruso, flight nurse Clint Mitchell, and flight medic Greg Rosenthal. The service was attended by Clint Mitchell's fiancée and his new baby, born less than 8 hours before.
I love my job. Those were the last words I heard from Clint.
Matt Thompson, EMS Outreach Coordinator for Spirit, knew them all. He says Greg Rosenthal was highly trained.
He was the rock, knew how to handle every situation.
Rico Caruso had logged more than 3,200 flight hours before the fatal crash.
Rico was one of the most respected pilots, not only in our area, but nationally.
Thompson says all three excelled at a very difficult job.
They are working with the patient from the time they lift to the time that they deliver that patient. They're experts in what they do, and they prepare for all scenarios. Our team was as good as it gets.
The Ascension Spirit flight went down in clear skies the night of April 26 in Hazelhurst. The National Transportation Safety Board says the single-engine Eurocopter AS-350 underwent an extensive safety examination the day before, but there is at least one observer who thinks that helicopter shouldn't have been flying. Dr. Michael Abernathy is the chief flight physician of UW Health MedFlight in Madison.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a physician in the United States who has spent more time in the back of a helicopter caring for patients. I've been doing it for almost 30 years.
Like Ascension Spirit, UW MedFlight uses helicopters and pilots provided by the Air Methods Company. Abernathy says they do an excellent job, but both of the MedFlight helicopters are twin-engine models. Abernathy says single-engine helicopters, like the Eurocopter that crashed, shouldn't couldn't be used for medical transport.
Redundancy. In the event of an engine failure, you still have a second engine. If you go to the rest of the developed world, no one uses small single-engine helicopters. No one.
Abernethy says of the roughly 1,000 medical helicopters in the U.S., 16% of them are single-engine Eurocopters or similar models. But they have been involved in 55% of the 27 fatal accidents since 2009.
I personally would never work on one, knowing what I know.
In a statement drafted for WPR, Air Methods says, quote, as a result of our strong safety culture, stringent inspection and maintenance programs, and compliance with several audit programs, we have found the reliability rate of single-engine helicopters is nearly identical to twin-engine helicopters. Additionally, the single-engine helicopters used in our fleet today are equipped with the same essential safety equipment found on larger twin-engine helicopters, end quote. The Ascension Spirit and Air Methods program had to meet standards set by the Commission on Accreditation of Medical Transport Systems. Dudley Smith is the Associate Executive Director.
Programs are required to have a safety management system, and then there's also standards in there about what kinds of equipment and things need to be on the vehicles. We're doing everything we can to decrease the likelihood of accidents happening.
At the memorial service, no one questioned the commitment of Ascension Spirit and Air Methods to safety. Vince Freeborn of Air Methods said the teams were eager to get back in the sky.
We're going to be here to stand Spirit 2 back up. And we're going to stand Spirit 2 back up in the honor of Rico, Clint, and Greg.
Six medical helicopters flew in formation overhead, a show of support from across Wisconsin. Inside the church, the last call went out from dispatch.
Pilot Rico Caruso, Flight Nurse Clint Mitchell, and Flight Medic Greg Rosenthal. Godspeed to Heaven's Open Door. Spirit Communication Center, clear.
The cause of the crash is still under investigation. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there's been a series of new lawsuits over sexual harassment in the fast food industry. We'll find out how ongoing harassment issues are affecting some of the country's lowest paid workers. Oil prices are moving up as we head into a big driving weekend. An industry analyst gives us the latest news and forecasts and what kind of prices we might see at the pump over the summer months. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, two Wisconsin farmers give us the lowdown on making the best use of fresh seasonal produce. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.